Hello and welcome to episode 215 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director here at the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other postings. How are you this fine morning, Bill?
I'm doing great, Seth. My home studio is coming together. I think this is the first episode we recorded with my stuff hanging on the wall behind me rather than the green screen with my submarine displayed on the green screen. Be interested to learn whether people think like this better or the green screen better. But I got to tell you, after 26 years in the Navy, I got more stuff than I have wall. So I've got a bunch of other things still sitting on the floor over there that I don't know where to hang. But long-winded answer to your question today, Seth.
No, stuff is cool. Stuff is very cool. I think the stuff is cool. I personally like stuff. For those who are watching, it's very obvious that we have another guest with us today. This week, we are happy to welcome a new guest to our program. This gentleman is the writer or collaborator on over 20 nonfiction books. He is a New York Times bestseller. He was awarded the DOD's Thomas Jefferson Award for Best Article in 2010. And he spent some time in my hometown back in 2005 when we had a little thunderstorm come through there called Katrina. More pertinent to this show, however, he is the author of the absolutely fantastic book that we've mentioned before, and we're going to talk about heavily today, Race of Aces, World War II's Elite Airmen and the Epic Battle to Become the Master of the Sky, which, of course, is about the air war over New Guinea and the Philippines. Please welcome John Bruning. John, how are you today?
I am great. It's really a pleasure to be here and really enjoy talking with you guys. So I can't wait to dig into a subject that's close to my heart.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be a good one. I think a lot of people are going to dig on this. Before we get to the intro, I just want to make a PSA, if you will, for the podcast. Please like and subscribe to our YouTube videos. I usually say it at the end of the videos, but I get a very, very strong feeling that most of you guys, as soon as I say the words, and with that, you stop. So please like and subscribe to our channel. We do appreciate it very much. It helps other people get the information that we're trying to put out here. So thank you for those who have and for go ahead.
Yeah, Seth. As we record this today, we crossed the 10,000 subscriber mark. So thanks to all of you for subscribing. It's really important because it helps the YouTube algorithm get the podcast out to even more people. And I think everybody who's listening to this right now realizes that that Americans need to know more about World War II. So it's really important. And as we do this, we're also approaching the 1 million views on YouTube threshold. This morning, we were at 980,000. That's a remarkable milestone. When Seth and I began this, we didn't think we would last 2 months. And we're so grateful to all of you who are subscribing and watching, you know, this very, very important story of heroes of World War II. Because if you don't listen, you know, it doesn't get out there. And I worry that, and I've said this a dozen times, that people are forgetting. It'll soon be like the Civil War is, that it's ancient history that nobody cares about. And I'm so grateful to all of you for subscribing and watching and keeping these stories alive. Thanks, Seth.
Yep. No, we're all very, very grateful. And we hope we can continue to entertain and educate at the same time. So on with the show. As we all know, the skies over Guadalcanal were a beehive of activity. The beehive was kicked over in August of 1942, and the bees continued to buzz throughout the rest of the year, well into 1943. The air action over Guadalcanal ate up an enormous amount of newspaper ink back in the United States. Actions of men like Joe Foss, John L. Smith, and Marion Carl were splashed all over the headlines from coast to coast. Yet, the men of the Cactus Air Force were not the only headline makers literally blazing a trail through the skies of the Pacific. They often tended to share headlines with men who were flying from airstrips that were just as primitive, if not more so, flying with minimal parts and airplanes that looked space age, but were often held together with the proverbial spit and baling wire. The men who flew from Dobadura and a little place called Seven Mile Drome near Port Moresby in 1942 and 43 were part of an air force that carried the load in the Southwest Pacific and played a vital part in the Allied advance in New Guinea. Of the hundreds of airmen who flew with the 5th Air Force in 42 and 43, we're only going to focus on just a handful in today's episode. These pilots, all fighter pilots, laid waste to the Japanese in the skies over New Guinea and in turn ignited a fierce competition amongst themselves, the likes of which had not yet been seen in the war. The Ace Race, as it was called, initially shared and then dominated headlines across the country, creating national heroes out of farm boys and misfits who were in deadly competition to become the United States ace of aces. And to that point, we could not have a better guest on our show than you, John. So let's start at the beginning of the 5th Air Force without getting into too much detail so we can get into the meat of the story. But the 5th Air Force in 1942, they had taken a pounding all the way across the Pacific, had they not?
Absolutely. The genesis of the 5th Air Force really starts in the Philippines in 1941. And just before Christmas, MacArthur ordered Brereton, his air commander, out along with some staff to Australia. And that really was the gestation of the 5th. When those guys got to Northern Australia, they literally had nothing. There were, you know, a handful of A-24s that the Army Air Force version of the Douglas Dauntless that had been destined to go to the Philippines that got waylaid en route in Australia. And that was really just a few other P-40s, and there was a handful of B-25s that were supposed to go to the Dutch and the Dutch East Indies. And that was really it. And it took quite a while for the situation to be stabilized. And that really didn't happen until Kinney got there in the late summer of 42.
And even before Kinney got there, and especially when Kinney got there, and we'll talk about him in just a minute, that the morale, and we hit morale all the time in this show because, you know, I don't think people realize, or hopefully they do now after listening to us, that morale is huge. You know, it's huge in terms of fighting force, whether that be the 5th Air Force, 1st Marine Division, or a squad. You know, that's huge in this time period. Before George Kinney got there, and then shortly thereafter, morale was in the can. I mean, it was garbage, was it not?
It was generally terrible, with a few exceptions. The 49th Fighter Group, based out of Darwin, was having tremendous success with the P-40. They were intercepting Japanese raids, and they had the time to get some altitude above the Japanese bombers. So they were doing what Claire Chennault's guys were doing with the AVG over in the CBI, which was, you know, fast diving passes through the bombers and then running. So they were doing well. The guys who were defending Port Moresby, the fighter units, the 8th Fighter Group and the 35th, they were taking heavy, heavy losses because they were flying the P-39, and you just couldn't get a P-39 to altitude, especially after the Japanese took the forward lookout stations for Port Moresby. They went from having like 40 minutes warning of a raid to less than 8 or 10 minutes, if that. So they didn't have time to get to altitude, and the Zeros would drop on them and cut them up. And the P-39 was a terrible aircraft above about 12,000 feet anyway. So the fighter units were really suffering, and the bomber units were as well. I mean, the 3rd Attack Group had a squadron, I think it was the 8th Bomb Squadron, that tried to use the A-24 in action. And they, every time they went out, they got shot to pieces. There was a mission with A-20s that the 3rd Attack Group had, where they went to Leh, and one of the fellows I interviewed for Jungle Ace, Don Good, was on that mission, I believe, and they lost 5 of 8 aircraft. Don was later shot down and escaped and evaded. I mean, it was a really, really dire situation. The aircraft were not suited, and the Japanese they were facing were veterans with very high morale.
Right.
Yeah. And if you fly in an airplane, you're pretty confident it's going to get you shot down. That's not going to do much good for morale. And we talked about the fact P-39 was used by a lot of our allies, and the only ones that seemed to like it were the Soviets, right?
Yeah, because they just kept it right on the deck. You know, people don't know this, but the P-39 actually fought against Luftwaffe too. There was, I think it was the 82nd Fighter Group in North Africa, very briefly flew P-39s after Torch, and they got rid of them as soon as they could. I mean, they were using them at low altitude, but still, I mean, against a Messerschmitt 109 or Focke Wulf, you were just not going to survive long with P-39.
Yeah, easy meat. Easy meat.
But, you know, Bill, the point you made about, you know, getting into an airplane time after time, day after day, knowing it was inferior, knowing your chances of returning home were pretty minimal. I talked with Jim Moorhead, who was one of the fighter pilots who went up and fought in the Dutch East Indies in 42 and later became an ace. And as I was interviewing him one afternoon in 1998, he described in detail to me what it was like trying to essentially psych yourself up to get into the cockpit and fly another mission after watching so many of your friends die day after day after day, knowing that you stood almost no chance. I mean, that's something.
You know, it's funny because people think about the 8th Air Force when they think about that mentality, right? They're going to be, in that case, flying daylight bombing missions over Europe. The problem was not the airplane. The problem was the, you know, the threat environment and our lack of fighters that can keep up with bombers, right? In this case, what people don't understand is that the fighters pilots were facing many of the same tensions as they were flying missions in the Pacific. And that was, that's just a great point, John, that I don't think people get a good sense for.
No, I'm like, how can you go to war day after day with equipment you have no confidence in? I mean, really, the nearest comparison I could make is 03-04 Iraq, where our guys were driving around in Humvees with no armor, and they were you know, throwing anything and everything onto the sides of those things to protect themselves from RPGs, IEDs, and small arms fire. I mean, and talking to those guys when I wrote The Devil's Sandbox, it was like, you know, going out, you knew your gear could get you killed because it really wasn't up to the mission.
Or the German submarine force where they lost 700 plus submarines, right? But we digress. Getting back to the 5th Air Force there, Seth.
So The 5th is seen in 1942. They're seen as kind of an outcast Air Force. They don't have, you know, this is after Brereton leaves. They don't have the best leadership. They don't have really good leadership at all, frankly. Enter a gentleman by the name of George Kinney. Now, George Kinney is one of those figures in Pacific War history that he's one of those guys that a lot of people don't talk about, you know, because they talk about Admiral Halsey and Spruance and Nimitz and people like that. But Kinney's, in my opinion, he's right up there with them in the terms of being an amazing leader. Let's talk about him a little bit. He was born in Canada. I do know that. And he was raised, let's see, he was raised in the Boston area. He wanted to fly, obviously, early in his career and his life. He goes, he flies in World War One. He gets his wings in 1917, flies with the 91st Aero Squadron in France in February 1918. He saw a decent amount of combat time over the Western Front in World War One. I think he got a kill or two, if I'm not mistaken. He's, you know, he's a pretty highly, you know, combat experienced guy after World War One. He gets his DSC awarded by General Billy Mitchell. I mean, he's, you know, he's a guy that's got some skins on the wall yet. His career kind of starts to take a little bit of a roller coaster turn because he's a man after my own heart. He doesn't hold his tongue. He likes to say what he feels needs to be said, whether it offends people or whether they want to hear it or not. He's going to sit there and tell the truth. So at one point, he becomes the assistant chief of staff for plans and training under then Lieutenant Colonel Frank Andrews. It's between the wars now. In this role, Kinney was to assist in the creation of GHQ Air Force, a central command designed to promote and accelerate air power within the United States Army. Never one to shy away from a challenge, Kinney was an outspoken opponent of the bomber mafia. And this is a whole nother conversation that we could get into. Yeah. But
that's another episode, isn't it?
Oh, totally. Yeah. But to that point, the Army Air Corps, which is what it was called at this point, not the Army Air Forces, which in 42, the Army Air Corps was dominated, kind of like the Navy was dominated by the battleship admirals. You know, it's a very similar thing in that they were dominated by this, as I call it, the bomber mafia. They believed that the only way to win a war was through strategic bombing. Yet Kenny was not of that ilk, was he, John?
No, in fact, he opposed B-17 production at a time where that was the entire, you know, reason for being for most of the Air Force, Army Air Corps commanders. Kenny, after the war, was a low altitude attack guy. He actually commanded the 3rd Attack Group, and I have photos of him screaming around Hawaii in various pre-war aircraft right on the deck. And so the 5th Air Force ends up reflecting that characteristic of his in a way that you don't see in any other theater. He was a rebel. He did speak his mind. But the thing that people forget about Kenny is that he was an engineer by training. He was a civil engineer before he went into the military. So he had a very good grasp on machinery, what could work and what couldn't. And you see that play into how he ends up innovating and allowing his men to innovate time and time again. So that engineering background really, really becomes an important part of how the 5th Air Force became so successful.
Yeah.
What I was going to say is that now makes it make more sense that he adopts this airplane that we're going to talk about in a minute, that I think normal fighter pilots would have said, that's not a fighter. That thing's not, you know, but he understands it technically. All the great things that this airplane could do, and that allows him to develop tactics and concepts of operation for operating the airplane and flying that maybe another leader would not have.
Absolutely. So, excuse me, to that point, you know, Kenny makes a lot of enemies, shall we say. You know, his mouth kind of sometimes writes a check that his ass can't cash at that point in his life. But he speaks his mind and they value his opinion, but they also don't value his mouth too much. But regardless of that, he stays in. He does get promoted, which is fairly impressive, really, when you think about the enemies that he did make, that he continues to climb the ladder. So clearly they saw some talent in the man in terms of leadership and ability. In 1942, he gets the somewhat unenviable task of taking over the 5th Air Force. And of course, that comes under the purview of our old friend, General Douglas MacArthur. Kenny was well aware of MacArthur's reputation as a pedant, you know, as just not a good guy to work for. But he also realized that he had to make this relationship with Mac work. And John, you can speak to this a little better than I, because he knew that this was probably his last chance. So
it was his only shot. So before he was offered the 5th, and the only reason why he was MacArthur actually said he was one of the few acceptable guys he would take. So Kenny had done various engineering roles within the Air Corps prior to the war beginning. So when the war broke out and they started to manufacture and deploy the very first P-38, the combat capable one was the P-38E, the first one. They were having massive issues with it on the West Coast, 4th Air Force. And they asked Kenny to go in and figure out why there were so many crashes. And so they were using him kind of as a fire brigade problem solver stateside. And that was likely where he was going to stay, was doing those things. He was good at it. There was no chance he was going to the first team, which was the 8th Air Force and the 15th Air Force. No way that was going to happen. They weren't going to give him a strategic bombing command at all. So when MacArthur said that he would accept Kenny, it was his only shot. and his only shot was a totally disorganized force that had virtually no supply chain, that had no commitment on the part of the senior American leadership to support as it needed to be supported. And the reality was he took it because there was nothing else coming his way in terms of a combat command.
Right.
An optimist could say that he got the job because he had, before we entered the war, he was sent to Europe to observe how that was going. And you could say that, hey, this guy's learned a lot from his European experience that he could bring to the Pacific. A pessimist would say, we don't like that guy. The way we're going to end his career is by getting him to work for MacArthur. If that doesn't end his career, nothing will. Which is there a truth in either of those?
I think there's truth in both. I think the reason that his time in Europe and his scathing reports on the state of American aviation after seeing what was going on in Europe, both made friends and enemies simultaneously. But it really showed that he was dialed into the nitty gritty on the engineering side of aviation. He had definitely had that experience, but boy, there's something to be said about sending him to MacArthur because MacArthur would chew up his air leaders. Now Brereton mm-hmm. was able to escape and he ends up going to the Mediterranean theater. And for years after he and MacArthur battled over who was responsible for the destruction of the bomber force on December 8th in the Philippines in 41. And then the subsequent leadership within the 5th Air Force and FIF didn't impress MacArthur. He wasn't really interested in the aviation side of things. He always felt like the air generals that he worked with were always over promising and under delivering. So he was very skeptical when Kenny arrived, for sure.
Yeah. So Kenny knew, you know, we've had a couple episodes where we really dig into Douglas MacArthur, and we're not going to do that here, but he had a guy that worked for him named General Sutherland, and Sutherland was kind of like his, I don't know.
Almost
he was
deputy. His gatekeeper, certainly.
Gatekeeper. Yeah, I mean, gatekeeper. That's a very good term. Yes, gatekeeper. Exactly. And Kenny knew that he either had to suck up to Sutherland or circumvent him and put him in his place. And he chooses the latter. And he has now, there's no documentation on this. It's just reported. I know there's a conversation at some point, theoretically, that happens between the two, Sutherland and Kenny. And Kenny, who had heavy influence on the air operations in the Philippines in 41, 42, where they got pounded, is trying to tell General Kenny, you know, this is what you need to do and this and all this other stuff. And Kenny takes a blank. He takes a blank piece of paper and draws a dot on it and says, this is what you know about air operations. And the rest of the picture is what I know about air operations. So basically telling Sutherland to shut his pie hole because I got this. And
yeah, Sutherland was a civilian pilot, right? And I used to be a civilian pilot as well. And I wouldn't presume to tell an actual air combat commander, you know, how to fly airplanes.
Right. So it's kind of at that point where Kenny, I don't want to say he gets a free hand because, of course, MacArthur has his fingers in all the pies, but Kenny is allowed to do more probably under MacArthur's purview than most, for sure, if not anybody else, really. He's allowed to do what he needs to do. He had a great respect for the Japanese, even though he had not seen very much in terms of their performance. He had read a lot and he'd heard a lot and he, you know, talked to his people firsthand. So he knew that the Japanese that were flying and their machines, these guys were good. These guys were, you know, talented. They had superior aircraft, and that, you know, his way of looking at things in 1942 is very similar to what the 8th Air Force did in 1944 into 43, early 44, is that he figured that in order to make air operations in the Southwest Pacific work, he had to achieve air superiority. Duh. And in order to do that, he had to kill Japanese fighter pilots. So while, you know, Pappy Gunn and his boys are out there strafing the bejesus out of merchant ships and everything and doing a fantastic job, he knew that in order for those guys to be able to do that, that skies had to be relatively clear of Japanese fighter aircraft. Therefore, I need more fighter squadrons, and I need guys that are going to go in there and just beat the Japanese down every single day. But as we said earlier, you're dealing with a group of guys who some of them are, you know, very sure of themselves, but a lot of them aren't. So he decides to bring in somebody, John, that we talk about, who is at that time the most famous American fighter pilot in history, Eddie Rickenbacker. And they, between the two of them, tell us a story. They kind of cook up a plan to incite the fighter pilots under his command, right?
Yes. Now, the story, as Kenny told it, was not entirely accurate. And it wasn't until there was no reporter present that I could find. And it wasn't until after the ace race really was underway that the guys reflected back on that moment at 14 Mile Drome and realized that was probably the start of it. It was probably I don't want to say the spiritual start, but the actual discussion of it. It was all in good fun trying to raise morale. But the first thing to keep in mind about this is that Dick Bong was not present. So the guy who actually wins the ace race was flying that day. But Eddie Rickenbacker had just been sent down to the South Pacific on an inspection and morale boosting trip. He ends up in the water and he spent weeks at sea after his B-17 went down. He gets to New Guinea. He's skinny. He's telling stories about their ordeal. Kenny, is sickly, and Kenny wants to know if, you know, he wants to take a break and get some rest and recover his strength. And Rickenbacker's like, hell no, take me to the fighter pilots. So they went to the 39th Fighter Squadron, which at the time was the only one flying P-38s in theater. These were aircraft that Kenny had specifically requested from 4th Air Force. They sent 50 in the summer, and the pilots that were selected to fly them ended up turning wrenches and screwdrivers to build them right alongside the mechanics, because they were so shorthanded and it was such a monumental task. Nobody had put together a P-38 before. And as I recall, there wasn't much documentation on how to do it that came along with the shipments of these aircraft. So the guys were just starting to get the P-38 into action. The men from the 39th had been flying P-39s prior to that. Some of them were pretty experienced, like Tom Lynch. So they had seen the worst of it. And now they had an aircraft that could at least bring parity in the air over New Guinea, at least they thought. And Rickenbacker shows up and they're talking to him. And keep in mind, I think the top ace at the time was George Welch. And most of his kills were scored over Pearl Harbor on December 7th. So when somebody asked him, you know, how many kills did you get in World War I, Eddie? And he said 26, there was sort of a gasp, because the idea of anybody in this combat environment getting 26 of these incredibly experienced, well-trained Japanese fighter pilots flying a far superior aircraft in the Mitsubishi Zero seemed unobtainable. And the room got quiet, and Kenny realized there was an opportunity here, and also he needed to do something because morale was like, you know, just on a razor's edge. So he said, tell you what, you guys, the first person who beats Eddie Rickenbacker's score gets a case of scotch or bourbon. I can't remember. It was a case of liquor. Eddie said that. And then Kenny said, and I'll double it. I'll put in a case too. Ultimately, that case became Coca-Cola, because some temperance outfits in the States complained that it was just not morally proper to give our fighting men liquor.
God forbid.
The level of disconnect with the home front's another topic entirely. But I'm sorry, I'm sitting here smiling because my son's cat is just going completely bonkers around me. Oh, God, just go to sleep. But anyway, so that was the genesis of the race. First person to beat Eddie Rickenbacker's score, which was would have been 27. And it spread actually from the Southwest Pacific Theater to the Solomons and also into Europe as everybody was seeking to see who could beat, you know, the World War One top aces score for the U.S.
So just from a timing perspective, we just did an episode on the Black Sheep Squadron where the Marines were chasing the very same Eddie Rickenbacker, you know, score. Did this conversation with Rickenbacker happen before or after the, you know, Pappy Boyington and the Black Sheep?
Oh, it was. Yeah, Bill, that's a good question. The timeline, people confuse it all the time on the fighter chat boards and the Warbirds boards on Facebook. Yeah, that conversation happened with the 39th happened in November of 1942. And it was more than a year later that second tour that 214 went out on with Boyington as their skipper took place. So really where Boyington fits into this is really at the point where things where the ace race in the Southwest Pacific in New Guinea really starts to go off the rails and guys start dying. That's where Boyington fits in. So it's about a year later.
I see.
Well, let's talk about the airplane. You know, and there's P-38 geeks all over the world, and it is a radical looking airplane in many different ways. It was developed by, and this is, of course, is the bird that these guys do their killing with, of course, is the 38. It was developed by Lockheed in 1938. She first flew in 39. It was a very strange looking airplane. You had twin booms, two engine fighter, central nacelle, you know, almost like a pod in the middle of the wings. It was incredibly powerful. And as you alluded to a little bit ago, John, it was, Lockheed said it was an easy plane to fly, and to a point it may have been, but it had a lot of intricacies and quirks that initially when the thing was going in the air, it was killing its pilots. And it wasn't, you know, I mean, I have not read, you know, the level of P-38 discourse that you have, but I don't think it was ever at the level of being, you know, disqualified. In other words, the Army Air Force is saying, nah, you know, we're not going to fly this, but I mean, it was pretty close. It was killing a lot of guys in California and in the Pacific Northwest, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So the P-38, when it was first introduced, was a radically new design. It was incredibly complicated. It had tons of teething troubles. It reminds me a little bit of the F-35 program, but one that didn't take 20 years to...
Which is also a Lightning, right?
Yes, actually, yeah, a good point. So it had a lot of issues to begin with, and the fighter pilots who were training the other fighter pilots to fly it had barely any two-engine time. And so the recovery techniques that they were originally teaching for engine loss on takeoff or landing were the exact wrong ways to deal with these things. So if they lost an engine on takeoff or landing, they would go through the procedures that their pilot instructor pilots had taught them, and they would kill themselves. It was a horrible, horrible mess. And you look at the span between, I think it was March and June of 1942, there's somewhere around 180, less than 200 P-38Es built. And half of them in those 3 months ended up in fatal accidents. And some of them were just completely catastrophic. There was one lieutenant named Mitchell went right into a hangar at Mill Field, which is now SFO, just south of San Francisco. Another one went into, a hospital up in Washington. Another one killed a housewife. So they were falling out of the sky in just completely horrible ways. And, you know, Kenny was brought in to fix that. The other major issue that became an ongoing ordeal for the 4th Air Force, which was the Air Force on the West Coast, was the quality of the maintainers. And you never hear this when you talk about World War II and the Greatest Generation. But when you're about to go to combat and you're a fighter squadron or fighter group commander and you have a problematical guy in your unit, you don't want to take him into combat. Right. So they dumped them on the service squadrons back in California. So by, you know, the fall of 1942, when the 14th Fighter Group and the 82nd Fighter Group and some of these other outfits end up going to North Africa, they have left behind all their malcontents and drunks and you know, discipline cases. And by 43, the situation is calamitous. And there was a big investigation that was done and discovered that the aircraft were being so poorly maintained that, you know, some of the P-39s that they were using for training had rusted 50 caliber machine guns. There were corrosions, you know, they found in the wings, all sorts of issues. And so they were trying to put a stop to that policy, but all through early 42 and into early 43, that was hamstringing the training on the West Coast, and it was contributing to the accident rate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to have a little color. I'd like to add a little color from my flying days to what you just said, John, because last week we talked about the Corsair. And we mentioned that one of its names was the Ensign Eliminator, because it killed so many, you know, new pilots. And the reason that happened to the Corsair is this big engine, one propeller created so much torque that when you added thrust with that big engine and didn't anticipate the torque you were going to create and give it opposite rudder with your foot pedals, then it would just kind of flip over and kill you. And I mentioned last week that the movie Devotion kind of shows that happening to one pilot. Now, with the P-38, we had two propellers, two engines, and the props were counter-rotating. And the reason they rotate, the counter-rotate, just like two propellers of a modern torpedo counter-rotate, is to eliminate that torque. So if we eliminated the torque, why were these guys dying? Well, these two engines were so far apart, if you lost one of them, it created what's called asymmetric thrust, where one engine would be pushing forward and the other engine would be basically a big anchor drag, right? And it caused a different type of really bad thing to happen. And if you didn't put enough opposite rudder on to counteract that asymmetric thrust, and this is the same problem we had with the Tomcat decades later. And in fact, if the rudders aren't big enough, you can't overcome that asymmetric thrust, and there's no way to kind of fly the airplane. This makes it a very difficult airplane to fly if you don't have the proper single engine failure procedures in place. So that's kind of what you were talking about, I think, John, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The standard procedure in the spring of 42 was if you lost an engine, you firewalled the throttle on the other engine, which just increased
made
the
it
torque.
Worse.
Made it worse. And so the aircraft would just roll and go into a spin, and you couldn't recover from that at, you know, 100 feet. So, and Bong was in the 49th Fighter Squadron, 14th Air Force, defending San Francisco that spring. He got there the day after, actually, it was 2 days after a peculiar target, which was denoted Target 25, flew over the Bay Area and caused a blackout. And then while he was staying in San Francisco, there was another blackout and air raid warning. And so the severity of the situation was driven home to him. And then within days of being in the squadron, he was watching guys in his outfit die. I mean, coupled within the first few weeks after his arrival died. So it was a hot aircraft. It was very difficult to take it from a cruise you know, configuration to an actual combat configuration. You had to go through a bunch of steps, and you actually had to take your eyes out of the sky and into the combat, into the cockpit. And because of that, because of the different procedures, many times, especially early on, young and experienced pilots would make the wrong move or forget a step, and they would blow an engine right in the middle of combat. And so it was a difficult plane to master, for sure.
But to that end, it was perfect. Well, I don't want to say perfect, but it was certainly good for the Pacific. You know, a lot of them were sent to Europe in 42 during Operation Bolero, when 8th and 9th and 15th Air Force were starting their buildup. So the vast majority of P-38s went to Europe. However, there were some that were siphoned off to the Pacific by Kenny. But these things were perfect for the Pacific because of their range. They had the legs to get out to the places that they needed to be to strike the targets, or rather shoot down the targets that they needed to shoot down. So despite all their quirks, despite all their difficulties, they really were the best airplane that could be used by the Army Air Corps, Army Air Forces at this time in the Pacific to do the job that Kenny wanted to do, mainly because at that point, it was also the only choice that they had. I mean, the P-40, while a good airplane, it just wasn't going to do the job Kenny wanted to do. And the 39 was a trash pile. So it was a 38 or nothing. And it just so happened that the 38 did turn out to be, you know, the ace maker. I mean, it really was. You know,
we ended up building 10,000 of these things. So it must have done something right.
Footnote. Yeah. Oh, I think absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead. I was going to say there are only a dozen of them left today. And I think only five or six of them are flyable. But go ahead, John.
Yeah, no, I don't mean to bag on the P-38 because it is the aircraft that I love the most from World War II, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Going in with full understanding of what it was that they were dealing with and that they were flying with makes what they achieved even more remarkable. And so when I wrote Race of Aces, I went into detail on what was going on the West Coast, because my God, I had spent my entire life reading about the P-38 and reading about the Southwest Pacific. I had no idea the casualty rate was so high until I started going through. There was a fantastic series of books written on the fatal crashes in the States. There's three volumes of them. And at the moment, the author's name escapes me. It'll hit me in a minute. But I went through and read every single crash entry for P-38s during that time period, and I was just blown away how many there were. Yeah. It was
must have taken you a while. Yeah.
Yeah.
so let's talk about, you know, like I said, there were a lot of guys that were involved in the ace race, and unfortunately we can't cover, well, we could, but it would be a podcast in and of itself to cover each one of these guys. But we're going to talk about a couple of the main players. And the first one is probably the most famous one, Richard Ira Bong. You mentioned him just briefly a minute ago. He was a farm boy. He was a boy from, you know, nowhere, Wisconsin, with a population of what, like 300 and some odd people. I mean, you know, Mayberry. And he goes out and he joins the Army Air Forces. He becomes a pilot. Like you said, he has a few trends, kind of like Kenny. And actually, he met General Kenner before he goes to the Pacific, and probably not the way he wanted to. You know, there's a few transgressions that Bong gets himself into, and we'll get to that in a second. But what kind of a guy was Richard Bong? You know, we all have this image in our mind of the Ace of Aces being this, you know, superhero, and to a point he was. But what kind of a guy was he? What kind of a cat was Bong?
He was a hardworking, family-oriented, quiet guy who put his head down and did his job. Mm-hmm. And he was from a very hard scrabble farm family, lots of kids. I actually visited the farm when I was doing the research for Race of Aces, and I stood in his bedroom, and he grew up sleeping on a on a bunk that was beside a sloping roof. So he had virtually no space. So he was used to really kind of rough living. They had, I think, one bathroom in the entire household. Grew up doing chores, hunting for food, was not a stranger to hardship or trauma or grief. When he was, I want to say he was a little, maybe towards his senior year in high school, there was a spring snowstorm. One of his sisters was very, very sick. They couldn't get her to the hospital because the roads hadn't been plowed and she had a very bad case of asthma. So they tried to tend to her the best they could at the house. And finally, when they were able to get the road plowed, they got her in the car. Dick actually carried her to the car and put her in the back of the family sedan, and they raced her to the hospital, but she died. I mean, these are things that you don't even think of in modern American life, you know, a sister dying. I mean, how many of us have had that experience at age 17 or 18? But, you know, in farm life, it was pretty common. And so Bong was a guy who understood what grief was. And in the years to come, when he's in the Southwest Pacific, he goes through his own share of traumatic and grieving experiences, but he's much more even keeled than some of the other guys. And he's definitely doesn't show his emotion like some of the other guys. And he got criticized for that in later years, for sure. But I really think it comes from his background. Like, he was just built to endure.
Yeah. He was often called aloof and cold-hearted, you know, by some of the people that knew him, and that more than likely was not the case at all.
No,
you know, to your point, he held a lot of
unlike stuff. Many of the other leaders, aviation, people that were leading the charge, he was not a hard drinking, hard living, hard swearing, super animated guy. He was a farm boy and the oldest of 9 children, I think. And so, there's no drama with this guy.
No.
Very quiet. Was not an egomaniac like you kind of associate with fighter aviation a lot of times. Right. It wasn't that way at all. He was just kind of this easygoing guy. And occasionally he'd be like the quiet guy in the room, who occasionally would just suddenly crack a joke and everybody would stop and go, "Did Bong just say that?" Start cracking up. Yeah. So
he wasn't above doing hijinks, though. I mean, there's a one time when he, as a wedding present to a buddy, he low passed over the guy's house, which resulted in a really not so good thing happening to him. What was that, John?
So there's a lot of misconception over what happened. They got Bong grounded in the San Francisco Bay Area. But really what happened was, as far as I could determine, and I actually did a lot of work trying to prove that he did a loop-to-loop over the Golden Gate Bridge or around the Golden Gate, as Kenny says in his book about Bong, that didn't happen. He may have flown under the bridge. There were other guys who were based out of Mills Field who flew under the bridge the same day, including a guy named John Mangus, who was from Oregon, who wrote a letter about doing it and getting grounded. And the guy that I mentioned who flew into the hangar, crashed in the hangar, Mitchell was with him on that mission or on that flight. But basically what happened was they had been standing alert duty, all flying canceled. They had loaded weapons in their aircraft, ready to intercept any bombers through the Battle of Midway period. So end of May to about June 8th, I guess, when they came off, sometime around then, they came off alert and went back to their regular training. So finally, they were able to get in the air. And when these guys got in the air, they were a little crazy. And Bong may have flown under the bridge. He didn't loop the loop around it, but then he went over to San Anselmo, just north of San Francisco, and just blew the doors off of his buddy's place. He had just gotten married, it was their honeymoon. They were in this house. He knew where it was. He came down and buzzed it as low as he could. And there was a housewife living next door who was in the backyard taking her laundry down. And when the P-38 came tearing over her place, it just ripped the laundry right off the line and spread it all over the place. And when Bond got back to Hamilton, he landed, there was a colonel waiting for him, and they put him in house arrest. And he ended up in hack the day his mom and sister came to see him, and they had saved all this money to try to come and say goodbye to him before he went overseas. And they showed up at the gate and he was under arrest. It was a bad situation, and they begged and they pleaded, and finally the colonel consented to let him come in and at least see Dick for a couple of minutes, but it was very short and they couldn't spend any time together. It turned into a terrible ordeal. And then ultimately what happened was he and a couple other pilots who all ended up in the Pacific, incidentally, ended up being called into Kenny's office in San Francisco, and he upbraided them and then dumped the incident report in the trash, which is probably why I've never been able to find it. I've looked everywhere. I went through all the 14th Naval District, I think it's in 14th, archives at the San Bruno branch of the National Archives, looking for anything, any clue on what happened. And the thing to keep in mind about Bay Area air traffic at the time was that there were so many areas that had restricted flight status or off limits. If you were to fly over X area, you were going to get shot down by the anti-aircraft crews because they were defending like the Mare Island shipyard. Or if you went south to the South Bay, there was an area only for airships. It was a very complicated airspace, and Bong and the other guys that day flying P-38s really just ignored all of that. It just went and had some fun.
Well, you got to blow off some steam at some point, and that's unfortunately they got caught is what it is what it amounts to. And you're never sorry until you get caught. But he was slated to go to Europe. What was he not? And then because he was grounded, he wasn't able to go to Europe, and they transferred him. And that probably saved his life, because when those 38s got over into Europe, the Germans ate them alive. I mean, they ate them alive.
So the 14th Fighter Group went, which the 49th Fighter Squadron, Bong's unit, was a part of, went to Torch. They were in North Africa. And they're the only unit that I'm aware of in World War II where an Army Air Force unit collapsed. Morale was so bad, they had to pull it out of combat. They broke it up. They sent most of the pilots home. Many of them ended up back at Hamilton, where they were interviewed extensively over their experiences. Leilu's cat is my co-pilot right now. So Bong almost certainly would have been killed, or his career would have just been over. The 14th was later reconstituted. They took leadership from the 1st Fighter Group and reconstituted it, and they went back into combat, and they did very well through the rest of the war. But that first 5 months or so in Northwest Africa was an absolute ordeal.
He gets sent to the Pacific, as we all know. He arrives in theater. He's assigned to the 49th Fighter Group, 9th Fighter Squadron, which really cool squadron nickname, the Flying Knights. You know, some of these squadron nicknames and group nicknames are just bad to the bone. This is one of them. it really is. I mean, it's like the Navy VF-10, the Grim Reapers. I mean, it's just, you know, just cool.
The Devil's Angels, is that right? Or Satan's Angels?
Satan's Angels. Yeah. I mean, they're 475. Amazing names. So not long after he's assigned to the 9th, he's temporarily assigned to the 39th Fighter Squadron to gain experience from those guys who had been flying for a while, not an eternity, but they had more experience than Bong did. And it's while he's there, he shoots down his first airplane. I don't know what it is. I think it's an Oscar that he shoots down regardless of this. He gets his first kill at this point. And we're not going to go all over all 40 of Dick Bong's kills. We'll be here for, you know, 8 hours, and we're just going to go over a couple of the fighting sequences that he gets into here. Some of the more memorable ones, really. John, on December 27th, 42, he's assigned to fly wing on another guy who was involved in the air ace race, a guy named Tom Lynch. Lynch is a veteran pilot. He's been around a while. I think he was already an ace at this point, if I'm not mistaken. The group is going to be flying over the battlefield at Buna Gona, which we did an episode on. That was a hellhole in and of itself. They're flying a routine patrol over that area looking for Japanese, looking for the enemy to shoot them down. They're flying in the classic, you know, finger four formation. They're up there just, they're hunting at this point. The guy you mentioned earlier, Ken Sparks and John Mangus. John Mangus is one of the guys. He's flying in the same flight. They're all over there doing their thing. And they're looking for the Japanese, and they don't really have to wait too long, as there are Japanese that do start coming into the area and they tangle with them. And we'll talk about them and talk about the fight in a second. But the Japanese that are in this area, we alluded to it earlier, these guys are not, you know, Johnny come latelys. These guys are veteran pilots. Most of them got service in China. Some of them, you know, in Burma and other areas. These guys have, there are a lot of aces in these groups. They call them, you know, the veterans of Nomen Han. But these are some seriously highly skilled Japanese, Imperial Japanese Army aviators. These aren't carrier pilots. These are army aviators. And these guys are bad to the bone. I mean, these guys are, they're about the best that are in that general vicinity, are they not?
Yeah, absolutely. And this was a very unusual mission for the Japanese too, because I'm sure you've brought up in previous episodes how much the Japanese Navy and the Japanese Army hated each other, right?
Right, exactly.
Well,
we did.
The original units that were fighting in New Guinea were Japanese Navy air units. And they just didn't have the numbers needed to contest the Fifth Air Force and really control the sky like they needed to. And they could see the power was increasing. The Fifth Air Force's air, you know, actual numbers were slowly increasing. Right. So they sent a wave of reinforcements to the theater, and they were from the Army. The 1st and 11th Sentais were the two that arrived first for this particular fight, and they joined with a squadron of Zeros and Japanese Navy Zeros and some D-3A Val dive bombers. Mm-hmm. And the 1st and the 11th, using Ki-43 Hayabusas, which I think we codenamed Oscars, were providing cover for this raid. So it was a joint strike by the Army Navy, and there were over 40 involved, and Lynch, Bong, Mangus, and Sparks spotted them over a place called Maggot Beach and immediately went in after them, and ground control then launched the rest of the squadron. So 8 more showed up, but they arrived piecemeal. So that first fight, real fight between P-38s and the Japanese, was a situation where the Americans were outnumbered 10-1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but to your point, Tom Lynch and Dick Bong and Mangus and Sparks, they don't really care. They're going in there to do their job, and that is to shoot down Japanese airplanes. Now, they have the height advantage here at this point, and they're diving down on these people. The formations, if I remember correctly, and it reads in my notes, the Japanese are stacked from, you know, 4,000 feet upwards to about 13,000 feet in stair steps, if you will. And they're diving down. The Americans are diving down on them from the altitude advantage. As Bong's diving down, he's hooking up about 400 miles an hour, and he can't drop one of his tanks. He tries to punch his tanks, and I think one of them, if not both, really, or some one of them hangs up for sure. And he can't shake the damn thing loose.
It took some time to get it off, for sure. And that broke up the integrity of the flight, the formation of four. And that was actually a pretty common thing to have happen. And later on, when they started using even larger tanks, they would often come off the racks and damage the underside of the P-38s, including the butterfly dive flaps that the later models had. So those things were always problematical. And Bong ended up with a pretty serious equipment malfunction right in the middle of his first fight.
Yeah.
But he was able to shake it loose.
Yeah, he gets it loose, and he's blasts right through this formation of Japanese aircraft. Because like I said, he's approaching, probably exceeding 400 miles an hour in this dive. And he literally just, you know, he's through these Japanese. And as he's pulling out, he gets jumped by two or three that jump on his tail. And he was told, he was told that the 38 couldn't outturn a Japanese, but it could outrun him. And that's exactly what he does here, is he slams the throttles forward and he just goes. Tom Lynch, the veteran, the ace that we were talking about, comes to his rescue and shoots at least one of these guys off of his tail, doesn't he?
Yeah. The other thing to keep in mind about the 38 was that it could climb a lot quicker than any other Allied aircraft in theater at the time. And that was a complete surprise to the Japanese. And these guys used the speed from that initial dive to extend out and then climb back up and get back above them. And once you can do something like that, you don't need an agility fighter. You don't need something that could turn inside the zero or even turn with it. You control the fight because you have the energy advantage thanks to the ability to get above them. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what these guys discovered that day. And when the other eight waded into the fight, it just turned into a melee of diving, climbing P-38s with these Zeros and KI-43s just unable to stay with them.
Yeah. And that dive, attack, pull up, dive, attack, that's pretty much their tactics. I mean, you know, obviously there's some guys who stray, but for the vast majority of their time, that is the tactics that are used by 38 pilots in the Pacific, is that get in there, hit, get out, come back and do it again. Basically rinse and repeat, you know, just over and over and over and over again. So as he's coming,
yet, but these are well armed airplanes too, right? With 50 cal and 20 millimeter rounds. And aren't they center mounted? So they're not spread out on the wings. So better. The parallax is not such a factor as you're trying to fire into the target.
Yeah, it's sort of the difference between having a fully automatic explosive shell firing sniper rifle and, say, a shotgun. Because when you look at the other aircraft that had wing-mounted machine guns, they all had to be set to various convergence points. And sometimes the ground crews, it really depended on the squadron, and sometimes the individuals. Sometimes they'd be set to converge at, say, 300 yards. Sometimes you'd have 650 calibers or eight in a P-47, and you'd stagger that. So there was kind of a zone where you could have these converge on a target. So from, say, 200 to 600, you'd have a good pattern on a target. With the P-38, it was just basically a straight laser right out of the nose with a cannon and 450s with a 20 millimeter. And those 450s, you could destroy anything the Japanese had at that point in the war.
Yeah, you're going to chew
it. It was devastating.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you had to be a better marksman, though. The P-47, you had tons of ammunition. You had eight guns and a big pattern that you could lay down. You could just, you know, spray rounds all over one chunk of sky. With a P-38, you had to be on the target. Otherwise, you're going to miss it.
Harder to hit the target with a rifle than a shotgun. Yep.
So as Bong pulls away, he loses the two fighters. He begins to pull up for more altitude, as we just talked about. He noticed at this point a lone Japanese Val dive bomber. This is one of the naval aircraft now, heading out to sea. He climbs in behind this guy, pumps 50s and 20s into it, and blows him out of the sky. Minutes later, he sees another one as he's climbing up. A fighter this time flashes in front of him. He sprays and shoots it down as well. So in his first real taste of combat, Dick Bong gets two kills on his first flight. He comes back over the airfield does the typical fighter pilot thing where he does the two slow rolls as victory rolls, shows everybody what he did. But this is two kills in his first flight. And it is really, at this point, it's only the beginning, because he starts stacking them after this. He has droughts as all fighter pilots do, but he really starts to stack them after this.
This was actually a crucial fight, not just for the Fifth Air Force, but for the entire history of the ace race. The aftermath in particular. So Bong gets back and the rest of the guys get back. Charlie Sparks is crash landed, but he's okay. He's the only loss. They claim 15, they get credit for 10. They actually get 5. The Japanese claimed 7. So, and only one was force landed and it was repaired. So it was, in the overall scheme of things, kind of an inconsequential fight, in terms of the numbers. But it exemplifies a couple of things. One, everybody overclaimed, and there's no shame in that. It's not like they're trying to, claim things that they didn't think they got. I mean, occasionally that would happen, but, for the most part, zooming around at 400 miles an hour, you have no time to see what blows up and what goes down. And if it's smoking and diving, they would claim it. In fact, Bong didn't claim one of the aircraft. It was only during the after action report that he was told that somebody else saw it go down. So that's when he put in the claim form for it. But it's the perception of reality that is sometimes more important than actual reality. And after the guys in the 39th had been beaten and battered by the Japanese for the better part of a year, all of a sudden they had a weapon where they just cleaned up. They thought they crushed this Japanese force, even though they were heavily outnumbered. And that was an enormous tonic to morale. And they were celebrating and partying and, just having a wonderful time when 7th Fighter Squadron's operations officer, Red Manning, shows up with a couple other guys, including Clay Tice. And he was livid because at the end of the fight, they were also sent up to intercept this Japanese force and provide some support for the 39th. Well, they were flying P-40s. And the controller didn't warn the P-38s there were going to be single-engine American aircraft in the area. And several of Manning's aircraft got shot up. And he was incredibly pissed. He wanted hides. He was screaming at him, swearing at him. It was an enormous scene. And ultimately, he unbuckled the holster of his sidearm and was about to draw it out when Tice and some of the other guys dragged him out of the scene, put him in a Jeep and got him out of there, and Cat's back. That was the catalyst for the Fifth Air Force painting their single engine aircraft with white tails after that, so that sort of thing wouldn't happen again. But the other thing that was consequential about that after action report was William Bonney was sitting in there as a fly on the wall. He was a former AP sports reporter who had come to the Pacific and had been one of those guys who didn't want to write stories from a hotel in Sydney, Australia. So right. He had been in the middle of the fighting in the Battle of Buna, sitting on a helmet or a couple of cracker boxes and typing away with a little portable typewriter and telling stories about the GIs. He was very much like Ernie Pyle in that regard. Yep. And he was, this is a guy who had a set of stones on him, like you can't believe, and he wouldn't quit. And on Christmas Eve, 1942, he was involved in a Jeep rollover and his back was broken. 2 vertebrae were broken. He ends up in a Port Moresby hospital, and instead of just sitting there and recovering, he's interviewing wounded GIs and writing stories about them from his hospital bed. And that's then awesome. He hears about this amazing fighter that has just arrived and has just scored a huge victory over the Japanese. So he staggers to a Jeep, drives over to 14 Mile Drome, walks in, and he listens to the after action, I guess we call it these days hot washes, the AAR, as the guys are getting debriefed by the squadron intel officer. And he writes the story of this, and it really touches off a whole series of press coverage of the 39th Fighter Squadron. And this is really the genesis of the media push behind the ace race.
Yeah, this is where these guys, not just yet, but it eventually become household names across the country. Guys like Dick Bong and others of his ilk. So, you know, we talked about this. This is the first fight that Bong gets into, but he rapidly starts, you know, making headway through the Japanese over the sky, in the skies over New Guinea. On the 7th of January, he scores two more. And then the following day, he gets another. This makes him an ace. So this, you know, he gets his fifth kill. This puts him in that stratosphere of ace pilots.
I think when Dick got into an airplane, he could be something he was not on the ground. And you know how when somebody drinks, their inner characteristics will sometimes come out. You know, you have the "I love you" drunks. I'm an "I love you" drunk. You have the mean drunk, that sort of thing. I think there's an element of that when you get somebody into a single seat aircraft. What you see expressed in the way they fly is an inner part of their soul that they don't manifest necessarily on the ground. And that was the case with Dick. He became a wild man in the air, and he was so good at pushing the P-38 to the limits of its envelope that he could go right up to that edge better than anybody, aside from maybe Tommy McGuire. We can get into him later, but Dick had more flight time in P-38s than anybody else who arrived to fly them in theater, because he had been grounded. And he ended up, once he was ungrounded, he did another, I think, 60 hours of training flights. So he had a lot of time in P-38s compared to everybody else. Yeah. So that, I think, set him up for success. Plus, Tom Lynch really took him under his wings. And Tom was the kind of leader that inspired everybody around him. He was a warrior to the soul. He was a kind and gentle spirit too at the same time. So he wasn't hard on his guys unless they absolutely deserved it. And he and Bong really, really started to form a kinship together, and which would, you know, cause major trouble and trauma later. But for that first period where he was with the 39th, Tom was the one guy who really saw in Bong not just a great fighter pilot, but a good human being. I mean, some of the other guys, excuse me, I'm dealing with the cat again. Some of the other guys in the 39th did not like Bong at all.
Right.
And when he left, there's one in particular whose diary is at the Nampa Warhawk Museum. And he writes about good riddance to, you know, Dick Bong. Didn't like him at all. That wasn't the case in the 9th Fighter Squadron, though. When he actually rejoins the 9th, when they get equipped with the P-38 finally, Bong is pretty well liked in the unit. And that first tour, and then, you know, things go south later on in the fall of 43.
Right.
But no, I don't think he was thinking about glory or becoming the ace of aces. Neil Kirby was that guy.
Sure. He set out to do that.
Was his entire purpose in life.
Right.
They were outnumbered 10-1 in that first fight, but in general, I mean, the Japanese outnumbered from Rabaul at least 2-1. So were they ever going to achieve numerical superiority in these early battles?
No. Off the top of my head, I cannot think of a fight that Bong, Johnson, McGuire, or Kirby were in, and McDonald, where they outnumbered the Japanese until
That's in the late
43, 44. Yeah. It took quite some time.
I'm hoping we're going to get to talk about a guy that I think has the best call sign in the entire Pacific War, and that's Duck Butt. Yeah, you heard it right. Duck Butt Watkins.
We're going to get there.
I look for how a guy gets the call sign Duck Butt. And I have no, and I've heard some really bad. I remember a guy named Spine Ripper, and you know how he got that call sign, Spine Ripper. Yeah, but Duck Butt. It's just one of those things that there's got to be a great story behind that. I just haven't found out what it is.
So Duck Butt Watkins was a Southerner, spoke with a real heavy Southern accent, was a short guy. And when he was walking with a seat pack parachute, he waddled. I mean, seriously waddled. And so the guys started calling him Duck Butt.
Yeah, there was a good story behind it.
He was from Mississippi, actually, Watkins was. Yeah.
Mississippi, yeah. Kind of makes sense, though, doesn't it? Yeah, and the fact that, and he was okay with it, is really not that anybody ever gets to vote on their call sign or override what the people call them. You know, it's one of those things. Yeah.
So over the next several weeks, Bong starts stacking the kills. By July 26, 1943, he's sitting at 11 kills. This day, however, is where his kill rate starts to jump. The summer of 43 had been very hard on the Japanese in the New Guinea area because of people like Dick Bong and his squadron mates and other guys that were flying in that area, because they were starting to, you know, we talked about this during the Battle of Santa Cruz episode, and that, you know, you had these elite Imperial Japanese Navy aviators who are slowly being whittled down. Santa Cruz is the killer of them. You know, that's the high body count battle, in my opinion, anywhere in that regard. And it was kind of a slower thing in the air over New Guinea in terms of the Imperial Japanese Army aviators. But the same thing is happening here. You know, they're slowly getting whittled down, and the experience level, not that these guys were garbage, because they certainly were not, but that high intensity experience level of all those, you know, hot sticks in one spot is slowly starting to be whittled down, and our guys on the flip side of that are gaining the experience. So that level starting to do one of these numbers in July 1943.
There's a wild card factor that the Japanese injected into that. We can talk about that, because it comes and plays right in with those fights that summer. And that was the introduction of the Ki-61 high end.
Yep.
The Japanese thought that they could recapture command of the air by deploying brand new aircraft into theater that had higher performance levels than the Ki-43. So the first was the Ki-61, and the second one was the Ki-45, which was a twin engine heavy fighter that was supposed to be comparable to the P-38, but didn't have the same level of performance at all. And it was the 68th Sentai that brought the Hind to New Guinea, and the speed at which they deployed this unit, the freshness of the aircraft type, the unfamiliarity with it that the pilots had, the lack of logistical support, it just crippled the effort. But they were able to get into action in July of 43, and a series of clashes really kind of determined the entire course of the next 4 months in New Guinea. For sure.
Yeah.
And Bong and Johnson and McGuire were all in the middle of that. And Duck Butt, too.
Duck Butt, love it. Bill, to your point, the numbers were, in July 1943, the United States intelligence estimated that there were 480-plus Japanese fighters, in the New Guinea/Rabaul area, whereas we had 200-plus. So it was, you know, a little more than 2-1, during that summer. So on the 26th of July 43, Bong and his squadron mates are sitting in the alert shack, and as I put in my notes, they're swapping lies, because that's what, you know, guys do when they're sitting around doing nothing. You know, they're telling stories that aren't true, shall we say. When the phone rings,
submariners never do that. Pilots do
that, right? It's honesty 100% of the time. So the phone rings. Japanese aircraft are inbound, headed for the northern coast of New Guinea. Pilots scramble. They lift off. 12 P-38s in three separate flights. When the flying knights reach the supposed area of intercept, the sky is clear. There is nothing there, nothing to be seen. The 38s are vectored to a new location where from 16,000 feet above, Bong is the first one, theoretically anyway, the first one to spot and call out the enemy fighter formation. It's here where his flight of four and a gentleman named James Duckbutt Watkins enter the fray here with their three other P-38s alongside Dick Bong. As the 38s close in on the flight, someone noticed enemy fighters behind Bong's unit. And I believe these are their code name was Tony on these Hiens, if I remember correctly, that they're coming in. Bong leads his blue flight down at the Oscars that are inbound while Duckbutt pulls a high G turn and goes after the aircraft behind them. In this fight that ensues here, Bong really goes on a bit of a rampage here. He gets four in this one melee in the sky. I mean, he just starts cutting them down left and right, doesn't he?
I can't remember exactly how many got. Duckbutt got four. Bong, I think, got four as well. And then Johnson, who would become their squadron commander, Gerald Johnson, ended up going nose to nose with a KI-61 in a head-on pass. I mean, it was a total game of chicken. And Johnson was able to stitch the aircraft along the fuselage and hit a wing tank, blow the wing off. The Tony started to spin, and Johnson pulled up at the last moment, but the flaming Tony spun right into his tail boom and chopped a big section of it off. And he limped back to Dobodura, and the first thing he did was he ran out and grabbed a camera and photographed his crew chief in front of the damage.
So he's able to land it like that. Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Johnson had done a tour in Alaska in the same outfit as McGuire. And when McGuire and he arrived, along with another guy who became an ace named Wally Jordan, they were called the Eskimos of the 9th Fighter Squadron. And they rose through the ranks pretty quickly. They were already first lieutenants, which created some resentment from the guys who'd been in theater for a while. Johnson eventually that summer takes command of the 9th Fighter Squadron from Captain Sid Wood, Captain Sid Wood. And he and Bong become very close friends that summer through all the fighting that they did together. And the Markham Valley fight was a really, really bad tactical situation because the Japanese were essentially able to achieve a pincer attack on them, hit them from one side and then from the rear. And had it not been for the skill of the pilots and the performance of the P-38, it could have been a complete massacre of the Americans. I mean, this is how we ended up killing so many Japanese pilots, was by doing stuff like that.
Yeah.
Superior. Bong liked this head-to-head attack method as well, the tactic as well. Didn't he achieve, several of his kills that way?
Yes, the head-on pass was actually a good method of attack for the P-38 because of the location of the guns. Mm-hmm. And it also presented a very, very slim profile, but nose-on. Head-on profile was very slender. It was hard to hit. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of advantages.
Zero angle in the bow is the way submariners would call it. Go ahead.
There you go. I wrote a book with Captain Ken Ruiz back in 2001 called Luck of the Draw, which was about his tours aboard the Pollock during World War II, but I have forgotten all of my submarine lingo.
That's okay.
We can in this fight, Bong does indeed drop four Japanese aircraft. For this flight, This brings his kill tally up to 15. For this flight, he's awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, which, of course, for those who don't know, this is the second highest award for valor that can be bestowed on someone in the United States Army. And at this point, the Air Force was part of the Army. And I'm going to read the citation verbatim here. It says, leading a flight of 10 fighters north of Leh, Captain Bong sighted an enemy formation of about 20 planes. He immediately led a series of three attacks and shot down two enemy planes. At this time, 15 or more additional enemy fighters joined in the engagement. Disregarding the greatly superior numbers of the enemy, Captain Bong fearlessly led in his flight again, and his accurate gunnery destroyed two more aircraft of three, which he himself attacked. The enemy formation was now dispersed, and the flight returned to its base without loss. Against numerical odds of more than 3-1, this flight, under Captain Bong's daring leadership, destroyed 11 enemy planes, of which he personally shot down four. First Lieutenant Bong's unquestionable valor in aerial combat is in keeping with the highest traditions of the military service and reflects great credit upon himself, the 5th Air Force, and the United States Army Air Forces. So it's at this point in his career that Bong is officially recognized for being a badass. This is where he gets, not just does he get to paint 15 kill flags on the side of his 38, which is obviously significant. The United States Army also begins to realize that this guy is the real deal. He is the man, and they don't hand out DSCs, you know, like Skittles. They even during World War II, when, you know, medals were handed out fairly often, this is still something that when you see it on a, you know, on a ribbon rack, you go, wow, because that's some serious stuff. He, by the end of July, then Bong is not the only one in this group, and the 9th Fighter Squadron is making a name for themselves. The group themselves are making a name for themselves, thanks in part to the efforts of the journalist. What's his name? Bill Boney? Yeah. He's the one that's getting their names out into the press.
Shows up during those Markham Valley scraps, and he's the one that sort of draws in several of the other aces, including Duck Butt, because Watkins was chasing Bong at this point. He had an incredible period of racking kills up that summer just before he went home after having kind of a lackluster early part of his deployment where he really hadn't been able to hit anything. And then he got his groove, and over the Markham Valley, there was a fight on the 23rd, the 26th, I want to say the 28th and the 31st. And then there was another one on the 1st. So these guys were in combat almost every day, scoring kills. And Watkins, I think he ended up leaving the first week or two of August with 11 or 12. And then Johnson had claimed two in the Pacific, or in the Aleutians, over Kiska, and then scored several in Probable and a couple of kills on the 26th. And then got into a real low level fight on the water on the 1st of August. So it was a target-rich environment, and the whole 9th Fighter Squadron was scoring. And this is one of the reasons why the 9th became the top scoring Army Air Force Fighter Squadron in the Pacific. And there was a big race going on between them and the 80th and the different squadrons in the 475th that kind of coincides with the ace race. But yeah, the Markham Valley fights were really significant, and they broke the back of the 68th Sentai. So the idea that the Japanese could overcome their pilot quality deficit with better equipment was just a complete failure.
Yeah, and if you fast forward to November, Bong has got, 21 kills? Now he's really chasing Rickenbacker's record.
Yeah, but he's at the edge of his endurance at that point. He's almost combat non-functional.
Yeah, he gets sent home.
A
couple of reasons. The first was the fights in August or July and August. There was also one on the 14th of June, as I recall. That was, you know, those battles took a lot out of a guy. You never knew if you were getting back or not. The stress, the constant flying at high altitude was a physical stress, sucking oxygen. It's all things that just wore you out physically. And then spiritually, I mean, that's more important really than the physical aspects of combat. I mean, if you are, if you're hurting spiritually, emotionally, your morale is low, you've got, you know, at some point you're going to become combat ineffective. And this bongs
12 o'clock high kind of stuff then.
Exactly. Exactly. There's always a breaking point for every pilot, every human. You have the bell curve, you know, where you have your steep learning curve, then you're combat effective, you're at your peak effectiveness, and then it starts to decline. And towards August, the end of August, Bong was at that point because he'd been in combat since I think he started flying combat in New Guinea in November, maybe October of 42. So it'd been almost a year. The living conditions were dreadful. They were dealing with all sorts of tropical maladies, mud, never being clean. The food was terrible. They were short of all sorts of extremely important things like vegetables and fruit. So, you know, everybody was underweight. They were stressed from a myriad of you know, just environmental factors, scorpions in their boots in the mornings. Mm-hmm. You had to kick out or you get stung. Dengue fever was common. Malaria was common. And then you had the Japanese night raiders who were bombing them frequently at night, keeping them awake. So they were sleep deprived. And on top of all of that, Bong had already lost a wingman in the spring of 43 during an attack over, I think it was Milne Bay. Didn't even see what happened to him. And he was really shaken by that. And he lost another one in early September. And that really sent him into a spiral. And he had just come back from a leave to Sydney, where the squadron had a flat called the Buckingham. Different squadrons rented different floors of the Buckingham. It still exists, actually, in Sydney. I'd like to see that someday. The parties there were legendary. And Wally Jordan took Bong down to blow off some steam, taught him how to drink, taught him how to smoke. There was some allegations of womanizing that Wally told me off the record. And Bong came back very worldly and ready to fight again. And then he lost another wingman and he spiraled. And at this point, Gerald Johnson had the squadron. And Johnson was one of these guys who was a leader who cared probably ultimately to the detriment of his own heart for the guys around him. He would do anything for him. The post-war epitaph on him was that he never lost a wingman. He was always very conscientious in the air. He was always looking out for everybody on the ground as well. And he could see Bong was at the end of his tether. He was getting a lot of press back home. He was, you know, national. He was a national figure at this point, mm-hmm. but he'd lost two guys. And so Johnson found a reason to send him back to Australia. And he spent his birthday at the end of September lying in a cot, just sort of doing a mental exercise to get himself out of this funk. And that was designing his own cabin in the woods when he got home.
Right.
And among the things that he wrote to his mom that he wanted in this cabin was a bowling alley. And he was like, "Don't worry, Mom, I have the money for this. I really do." So yeah, he was a, you know, young man who was in desperate need of a break at this point, and not something that was going to be cured by sending him back to Sydney for leave or 4 or 5 days. He needed to go home. But as we hit the fall of 43, the op tempo increases even more than the summer of 43, as Kenny is under increasing pressure to destroy the Japanese air power based at Rabaul, like they did in August at WEWAC. And those missions became sort of the high watermark of that entire tour for those guys. And it was the toughest period probably any of them experienced in combat, because You know, mission after mission went out to Rabaul. They were losing aircraft left and right. And the supply, the resupply of P-38s dried up because of the losses the 8th Air Force was experiencing. So Kenny got word that the entire production of P-38s was being sent to Europe and that they were just going to have to make do. And eventually they would get some P-47s to re-equip the P-38 squadrons. So it was a disastrous time for the few 38 squadrons in the 5th Air Force at that point, because they were running out of aircraft, they were running out of pilots, and they were just being flung day after day against Rabaul. And Bong returned to action in early October, shut down at Dinah, I think, a reconnaissance airplane. And then he was a key part of the Rabaul raids that the 9th flew. And Johnson needed him in the fight. He needed an experienced, good flight leader. Bong was never going to be a squadron commander. He just wasn't leadership material. But he was, and he was uninterested in that. In fact, after he lost this last wingman, he wanted to just fly solo. He just wanted to be left alone to, you know, basically go full World War One, you know, Oswald Bolka, and or what was his name, the Eagle of Lille, Max Immelmann, and just patrol by himself looking for planes to shoot down. Johnson vetoed that. He's like, no, we are a team. We will fight as a team. And I need you in the fight. And as soon as I can, I'll get you out of here. But right now we've got this mission set and it's not going to end until the, you know, Rabaul is reduced and there are no Japanese airplanes there that pose a threat to the landings in the Solomons. It was all culminating with the invasion of Bougainville over in the Solomons.
November, right.
So, it was a tough period.
He does get sent home though. They send him home in what? Around right before Christmas or right around Christmas time?
Well,
43.
Yeah, it's sort of a heartbreaking period because in two final missions to Rabaul, he loses two wingmen, Bong does. And I, you know, there's a lot of people who faulted him. There's a lot of scuttlebutt. There was a lot of talk. It's hard to see from what happened how he was responsible. But he lost George Haniotis over over Rabaul, and Haniotis went down. And then on the 7th, and this is really what kind of ruptures his relationship with Gerald Johnson, Bong went out with Gerald's wingman, who he was really close to. His name was Stanley W. Johnson. Really, really good, solid pilot, great kid. Gerald Johnson loved him. And they were absolutely thick as thieves. I think they both learned they were in love with a woman named Barbara. So that kind of bonded them to begin with when they first met. And then they started flying together and they were a duo. And Stanley always, you know, looked after Gerald in the air. And Stanley Johnson disappears on this mission. And when Bong comes back and has no real explanation for what happened, I didn't see, you know, what happened. He was there one minute and he was gone the next. That's what happens in fights sometimes. I think Gerald held it against him. And the relationship was ruptured. It was later patched back up a little bit, but then it gets problematical again in the Philippines. But shortly after that, Johnson is able to convince Kenny to send him home. And he goes home, I think, mid to late November. And there's a lot of changes going on anyway in theater, including the fact that the Flying Knights had to re-equip from their final seven or eight P-38s to P-47s. And at that point, they get Thunderbolts, which they hate. The other squadrons wanted P-40s rather than the Jug. And at that point, Neil Kirby takes temporary command of Fifth Fighter Command, and things really start going off the rails because he uses it as an opportunity
To hunt,
to go on the best missions and hunt. Yeah.
Yeah. So Bong is back home for about a month, and there's another cat that is starting to make a name for himself, and he's similar to Bong in some ways and different in a lot of others. He's an outcast. You know, he grew up as an outcast. He was born in New Jersey. He was raised in Florida. He was a little dude. You know, he wasn't popular. He was a braggart. He was a loudmouth. But in the air, he could back up his loud mouth. And of course, this guy that we're referring to here is the other main opponent, if you will, in the ace race. And of course, this is Tommy McGuire, who, in my humble opinion, was probably the finest aviator to fly in the Pacific, the War Army wings. He was incredibly talented at the yoke of a P-38. This dude did some service, as you talked about before. He did some service in the Aleutians with the Eskimos. See, he comes down into the Pacific, you know, he's flying this 38. He has a loud mouth, and he's ostracized initially. He serves with Bong, but he doesn't really see a whole heck of a lot of action because he's kind of kicked off to the side. He's not allowed to fly the fighter kill missions. He's allowed to fly, you know, like the busy work, if you will. And it really pisses him off, and in turn he pisses off the wrong people. And it's a bad situation for Tommy McGuire. He gets sent to a new group being formed called the 475th that you talked about. These are Satan's angels. These are the guys that are flying 38s. This is Kenny's pet project, is it not? The 475th, theoretically Kenny's pet project.
Yes, it was the first group in the 5th Air Force to be entirely equipped with P-38s. Mm-hmm. Because before they'd been equipping only one squadron in a group with them. So you had the 9th and the 80th and the 39th equipped with them. And then the 475th was going to be the mailed fist for offensive action for Kenny because they had three organic P-38 squadrons.
Yeah. So McGuire gets to the 475th, and he is placed under the command of a guy named Captain Frank Nichols. Nichols, I don't know a whole heck of a lot about him, but the one thing I do know about Nichols is that he recognized this innate leadership, even though McGuire was kind of a jackass. He recognized this innate leadership quality within Tommy McGuire, and he tried to foster that, which in turn does eventually turn Tommy McGuire around somewhat. But while he's with the 475th, McGuire, to what you were saying about Bong earlier, where he had a lot of hours in P-38s, Tommy McGuire has a similar set of circumstances in that he is made operations officer. I believe it's operations officer, isn't it? Engineering officer. I'm sorry. He's made engineering officer within the squadron. And he, in that role, he gets really close with the squadron mechanics, with the ground crew. He gets intimate with the P-38s and, you know, stripping them down, building them up, bore sights, the weapons on all the planes in the squadron. The guy knows probably more about the P-38, in my opinion, than the guys who built it, because he's around the things 24 hours a day. He can relate to the airplane more than he can relate to his fellow pilots, because, you know, he likes to shoot off his mouth and the other guys don't like that. But to that end, he learns things about the 38s along with Bong, like you were talking about earlier. He learns what the 38 can do and what it can't do. And he pushes that thing literally to the limits of the airplane's physical ability. Sometimes he'd bring it back with structural damage, not because he hit anything, but because he's pulling
the air freight.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's whipping this thing around in the air and throwing it around in the sky, like literally no one else on Earth could do. Yeah, and making it back all the time.
Acting like a test pilot, trying to redefine envelope, flight envelope. An engineering officer would be roughly equivalent to what we would call the maintenance officer today of a squadron, right?
I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, He manages the mechanics and things like that. And is one of the squadron department heads. And so you got operations, you got maintenance, you've got intel, you've got, they all work for the squadron deputy commander commander. Okay. Yeah, he was arrogant, good pilot, but didn't he finally, I mean, didn't it take him a while to get in his first fight with the Japanese?
Yeah, in the Aleutians, he was sent to Nome. So he was way, way out of the fight. And wow. Meanwhile, the pilots in the group were essentially rotating through the 42nd Fighter Squadron, which was based at ADAC, to get some combat time. And they were flying against Kiska. And that's where Johnson and Wally Jordan cut their teeth. And Johnson flew three missions to Kiska. So Tommy never got in the fight. The last thing he did before he got sent to the Pacific with Johnson and Jordan was go visit his mom back in Sebring. And that whole relationship was very problematical, but that was the last time he saw her, was in a hotel room. She was drinking pretty hard. It was just a really sad situation. She was living in the hotel because she'd burned through her inheritance that she'd kind of stolen from the rest of the family. Which had then in turn alienated her from the rest of the family. So she was this, you know, both of them really were Yankees in, you know, deep Southern Florida. They flashed their money around through, you know, Tommy's childhood trying. In fact, she quite blatantly made attempts to buy favor of, you know, the locals to play with Tommy, and it didn't work. So she ends up dying in that hotel room while he's on this tour in the South Pacific. The unique thing about Tommy is that he never went home. When he got back to his group after that leave, Sandy McCorkle, who became an ace in the ETO or the MTO, was his squadron or his group commander from the Aleutians. They were back in the States, stateside, domestic or contiguous states at that point. And I interviewed McCorkle about this decision to send these three guys to the Pacific, because normally, and we talked about this earlier, if you have a request for pilots or personnel, you cut loose your malcontents. McCorkle didn't do that. He knew that his group was probably not going to go into combat for a while. So he picked his three Tigers, Wally Jordan, Tommy McGuire, and Gerald Johnson. So they came in to the 9th Squadron together, and Johnson did everything he could to learn. He volunteered to fly missions, which is why his nickname became Johnny Eager. And Tommy was a show-off. And once he got reprimanded in flight during basically a workup flight to see what kind of pilot he was, he literally responded to that censure by bumping his flight leader with his own aircraft, you know, basically showing how good he was by ramming his tail. Well, this guy was a combat veteran who didn't brook any kind of nonsense like that, because he'd seen people die doing stupid things, and that poisoned his relationship in the 9th. And that's how he ends up getting cut loose and sent down to the 475th to be one of the founding pilots of the outfit. And he most certainly alienated people at first. He was all those things, Seth, you mentioned, and more. But the thing that most people sort of overlooked about Tommy in the source material is that this was a guy whose brain was operating at a different gigahertz than everybody else's. He was absolutely brilliant. He would be able to carry on three or four conversations simultaneously, almost like a whales. You know, whales can do that. They could talk to multiple people simultaneously. It drove people crazy in the scramble shacks when they were waiting to go on missions. And here's Tommy talking a mile a minute to multiple people at the same time, carrying on conversations, because he had a mind that could compartmentalize everything that was going on and process it, which made him an incredible fighter pilot in combat. And then, of course, his understanding and intimate knowledge of the P-38 plays this enormous role in his success as well. But deep down, this is a guy whose arrogance and his cockiness and his braggadocio really conceals a man who never fit in. And these were his weapons of psychological defense to that rejection. And he had to, in his own head, feel superior to everybody. And in fact, in terms of intellectual acuity, he probably was the smartest man in any room he walked into. And so what that concealed was a deeply loyal and really sensitive and easily wounded soul. This was a man who wanted the respect and admiration of those around him, but also he was unshakingly loyal, even to the guys on the ground who hated him and told him to his face that he was an SOB. In the air, he would do anything and everything to keep his guys alive.
Yeah, and that's something I want to talk about here, before we get too far down in there, is that ultimately that's what he lived for, was to take care of other people. And to your point, people who generally hated him because he was a dick, he wasn't a nice guy, but he would literally sacrifice his life to help out or potentially save, whatever the case may be, another American aviator, even if it wasn't from his squadron. I mean, he would do whatever he had to do to help those people out or save them. And it almost costs him his life. And we'll get to that flight in just a minute. But, Bill, to your point, he doesn't get into the fight really until August of 43 is when he starts getting his chance to back up all the talk. That he's been flinging out. He flings a lot of talk out, and he's like, you haven't done anything. You can talk the talk, but can you walk the walk? Well, McGuire can certainly walk the walk. On the 18th of August, 1943, he's flying. Well, it's not just him, but his formation is flying escort for a large group of B-25 strafers. He's one of like 100 aircraft, American aircraft in the air that day. So, I mean, it's a big, big fight. As the B-25s are going down to strafe their targets at WEWAC, they're jumped by a flight of Oscars above them, firing in wild sporadic bursts. Initially, Tommy settled in and began to do what he does best after, I guess it's that initial, you see the elephant for the first time and he kind of wigs out. And after he gets his senses about him, he just starts kicking ass. And that's pretty much what he does every time the guy gets in the air. As there's an Oscar, I believe, that gets on his, Tommy's wingman calls and says that he has an Oscar on his tail. And at this point, this is one of those early examples of McGuire doing whatever he needs to do to save his fellow man, or his fellow American, I should say. He pulls a 38 in a tight turn that probably no other aviator could do, and shoes the Japanese off his wingman's tail. And that turn, if I'm not mistaken, he puts himself at risk. And this is not the first time, or this is the first time, but not the last, that he does this. He puts himself at risk, opening himself up to be shot down, trying to save one of his fellow pilots. He does wind up shooting an airplane down in this mission. It's his first kill. And much like Bong, he kind of starts stacking them here from then on out. But the one thing that McGuire does, and he stresses this for the rest of his flying career, is teamwork. And while Bong was a member of the team, to your point, what you were saying earlier about Gerald Johnson and it's like, you're going to do this, McDonald, you are part of this team. McGuire stresses that to the nth degree. And later on, as we'll see in another episode, when we talk about these same guys again over the Philippines, Bong's attitude kind of pisses McGuire off that he's not part of the team, but that's another conversation another day. In the rest of this fight, McGuire and his wingman do that very thing. They work as that 1-2 punch, that two-man team, and they just start slaying Japanese in the air in this fight. I mean, they just it's the seeds. He sets the seeds for the rest of his career in this one fight. And it, almost everything he does in this one fight, he does for the rest of his career. And he doesn't, you know, and he doesn't stray. So, to the point of Tommy Maguire being a hot stick, by the end of August 1943, he had 7 kills to his credit, as well as a Silver Star and 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses in 8 days of combat.
Yeah, that's incredible. Think about that. Matt worked for me on that. Just, I don't know how somebody gets nominated for 4 medals for 8 days of combat. At some point, you roll all those up into one bigger medal, but okay.
I mean, that's how bad he was, you know?
That was part of the situation with Tommy. Never really got the recognition he deserved because he wasn't well liked, because his past growing up back home was problematical, divorced family. Mom ends up dying of alcoholism in that hotel room and is partially eaten by her dog before the staff gets the fire department to come and get her out through, they had to go in through a window to find out what her condition was. And the dad had always been sort of uninvolved. So ultimately, when they do start giving Tommy Maguire some ink, they whitewashed his past and just made him a son of New Jersey and didn't even talk about his Florida upbringing. So the fact that he was receiving these awards, I mean, they were extremely well deserved. And the reason why he was receiving them was, Tommy made the most of every opportunity in every fight he was in. He usually scored multiple times. Guys like Gerald Johnson, Bong, Kirby, to an extent, Tom Lynch, you know, they'd get one, they'd get two. They made the most of their opportunities also. But over and over, you see Tommy Maguire getting 2, 3, 4, coming home with, enormous numbers of planes on these missions. And I mean, you see it in August when he ends up, you know, his first couple of weeks in actual combat and contact with the enemy, he's racked up 7 kills.
Yeah. Did he almost get shot down at one point?
He does get shot down. He does get shot down. Oh, and that's what I wanted to talk. Yeah. This is what I wanted to talk about. And this is, you know, his love of his fellow man, his absolute duty to his squadron mates and other guys flying in airplanes with stars on the wings nearly cost him his life several times. But one specific time, it frankly probably should have cost him his life. And he, you know, he's kind of like a cat. He's got, like your cat there was roaming around. He's got 9 lives. And he damn near loses one of them here for sure. On October 17th, 1943, he's flying in a flight heading towards an area in which there's about 30 to 40 enemy aircraft that are causing his squadron to scramble and get up there and go engage these people. He's left off the flight roster that day. So he's not even supposed to fly. He steals his squadron commander's airplane. The CO had, it was, I think it was Nichols, right? Who had his own airplane. He had his own 38.
I can't remember if it was Nichols. I can't remember who squadron CO was at that point. But yeah, he had his own airplane that nobody was allowed to touch, and Tommy took it.
Yeah, and Tommy steals it. He tells the crew chief, fire up the bird. I'll take the rep. I'm going. And he gets in the airplane, and he does that very thing. He's up at about 23,000 feet when they're jumped by a flight of enemy fighters flying above them. And this is a rarity because the Japanese, usually the 38s held the altitude advantage, but this time the Japanese are above the 38. So this is a kind of a, you know, a rare set of circumstances in and of itself. He chases a fighter.
A group of fighters but by himself, right? Because he's got no wingman if he just stole the airplane.
Well, to an extent, he
linked up with the squadron. Yeah.
Yeah, he tags on with 4 other guys, I think, and kind of hanging out on the fringes. But he's there. He's with some other guys. He notices 2 Oscars coming in to attack his flight, the flight that he's kind of hanging on the fringes of. to that end, he goes in after these Oscars. As he does this, he loses valuable speed because he's climbing. He's trying to climb to get to these people. And in doing this, this allows four zeros to get on his tail. And these zeros start to shoot him up. They start to chew him up. He's got no speed. He's in a bad position. All he could do was dive. And that's exactly what he does. He rolls the 38 over, pushes it to the envelope that, you know, it's about to probably right around compressibility. And he just hauls ass and gets out of there as fast as he can, leaving those zeros behind him. This is the tactic that we were talking about earlier, where they're diving and regaining altitude to get back into the fight. He's doing the very same thing. He gets up to about 18,000 feet, spots three zeros. In the ensuing fight, he makes several passes and misses. Several fighters get on his tail, force him to dive away, only for McGuire to relentlessly join the fight again. He keeps getting into your point, John. The dude, it's like he's like a dog in a fight. If he's in that fight, he's in that fight. He's going to stay in that fight until he dies. He keeps getting chased out, and he keeps coming back in, just over and over and over again. He winds up shooting down a couple of planes in the fight. However, at one point, he sees a P-38 that's clearly crippled, that's trying to get away, and it's under attack by like seven Japanese fighter planes. 7-to-1 odds, you know, is not a good situation for anybody, but McGuire doesn't hesitate. He sees this 38 that's crippled, and he doesn't hesitate at all. He just, boom, he goes right in there to help this cat out, doesn't he?
Yeah, and the amazing thing about what he does, and I really feel like if he'd been any other person, he probably would have received the Medal of Honor for this, because when he rolled in on that attack run with all those Japanese aircraft behind him, but behind the crippled P-38 he was trying to save, right, he could have rolled up behind the last zero and worked his way forward and done at least some damage that way, maybe driven them off. But there was a zero in the front of the pack that had a bead on this P-38 and was shooting him up. And that became his target, despite the fact that by selecting that one first, he was putting the rest of those zeros directly on his own tail, and it cost him and nearly killed him. But he saved the P-38 pilot, who that crippled bird got away, and the pilot survived. But as Tommy shot that one off his tail, the others just piled on him. I mean, he stood no chance. I mean, that P-38 right, was just shot to pieces, and he was wounded. Very nearly got trapped in the cockpit. When he finally got out, he was in fact, I think he was trapped half in and half out of the airplane.
He was.
And just was thrashed around by the slipstream, and then ends up in the water where a PT boat ends up pulling him out. And he was so badly hurt that the squadron thought he wasn't coming back. He was just going to rotate home, and he had an opportunity to go home from it. It was, I mean, the wounds that he had were significant enough that it could have, you know, earned him a ticket to the States.
Mm-hmm. So to your point, his 38 took cannon hits from the Japanese 20 millimeter spraying shrapnel in the cockpit. He takes shrapnel from either the 20 millimeter round or the P-38 itself, or probably both, into his behind, you know, tears his butt up. Literally, he takes a 7.7 through the wrist. I think it's on his left wrist, but regardless, he takes a 7.7 through the wrist, shrapnel all in his right arm. So, I mean, he's bleeding pretty good, you know, from if for nothing else, through the hole in his wrist. The engines are taking hits, the airplane's going down. And exactly to your point, he tries to get out of the dang cockpit. And I think it's his chute strap or something catches on something in the airplane, and he can't get out. And the bird is going down. It's very clear that this airplane is going to go down, and he is going down with it. He cannot get out of it. He stands up, he keeps getting smacked down by the slipstream. It just keeps piling on. It's a snowball effect for him. He eventually does get out of the airplane. Obviously, he goes to pull the D-ring on his chute, and the freaking ring comes off in his hand, and the chute doesn't deploy. It's like something from a Bugs Bunny cartoon, you know, honest to God, it would be funny if it wasn't so, you know, serious. He winds up unpacking the chute and pops it. He does what, like two swings and bam, smacks the water. And he's bleeding out in the water from his wounds, but specifically the one in his wrist. Yeah. Yeah. That's another thing.
Breaks his ribs when he hits the water too. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a parachute was made by Acme Corporation.
As I was doing the writing and the research of that chapter, it was pretty clear that the chute itself had been damaged in the aircraft by either shrapnel or, you know, the round that hit him in the wrist. It was a really, really bad situation. And the thing was, he was bleeding. As you said, Seth, he was bleeding pretty badly. And that area is exceptionally dangerous for sharks.
Sharks. Yep.
And it's a miracle that he was picked up before the sharks got him.
Yeah. Yeah. His wounds are so severe, both combat wounds and, like Bill was saying, broken ribs. And he's got, like, his eyes are all black. Basically his face is so puffy and swollen, he can't see hardly. He can see, but not very well. It grounds him for 6 weeks at least. It puts him in the hospital, rather. Let me rephrase that. Puts him in the hospital for 6 weeks. And to your point, John, the dude should have gone home. I mean, those are wounds that most mortal human beings would have been like, you know what? I'm taking that as a sign. I am going home. Not Tommy Maguire. He gets back to his squadron and wants to fly. And when he gets back to his squadron, his eyes are still black. His face is still swollen. He can barely walk. And the flight surgeon is like, no, no, buddy.
No way. No way. He was half healed. He was in really bad shape, but he came back and did everything he could. At some point, I think he was even running the mess hall.
Yes.
Anything he could do to contribute. I mean, my God, that level of devotion is extraordinary. And again, had it been anybody else with a more gentle demeanor and less of a, you know, braggart, that was well worth a Medal of Honor. Absolutely.
Yeah. He gets a Silver Star for that action specifically. That's what he gets a DSC later on, but for the thing we just talked about, he gets a Silver Star, which, to your point, I agree 100%. That's Medal of Honor worthy action right there. I mean, he's sacrificing himself to save another man.
Truly.
I mean, that's, And he knew it too. It's like, I mean, to your point, instead of taking off the tail end, what's that?
The aviation equivalent of jumping on a grenade.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, had he worked his way up from the back of the pack, there's a strong chance that he might have lived without getting shot down. And, you know, maybe he could have saved the guy that way in the crippled P-38. But he didn't choose that because the situation, as he assessed it, was immediate and urgent. And so he sacrificed himself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's ultimate badass right there. Ultimate badass.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is when I was writing Race, I went into it with, you know, kind of a bias because I had written a book about Gerald Johnson that had started as my master's thesis. I knew the family. Gerald's widow was in my wedding party. But as I unpacked everything that I came to learn about Tommy Maguire, I realized that this is a really special human being. And he was overlooked because of his obnoxious patterns on the ground. I mean, he was obnoxious, but you know what, when I was 20, 21 years old, I was pretty freaking obnoxious too. So yeah,
exactly.
You know, but the thing was, he got a little mentoring and it tempered him. And ultimately when he got the squadron, he was a fantastic leader. That's all he wanted to do was run his squadron. And when it ultimately was taken away from him, in late 44, he was brokenhearted to be pushed up to group as a major. It wasn't a punishment. It was time to move on and move upward in his career. And he was just brokenhearted by that.
Yeah. He was a combat leader. He's a combat leader, a leader of men, and that's where he wanted to be.
And when you look at his career, he arrives in theater in March of 43, and he never goes home. You know, he dies January 7, 1945. Everybody else who is either in the race or he flew with did a year-long tour and then went home. And then they would sometimes come back for a second tour, or in Boggs' case, the abbreviated second tour and then a third one. Tommy never went home, and he was married too. He had married just before he went overseas. So it's remarkable. And the fact that he was able to push through what would have broken most others to be in combat that long, it's remarkable. He's a remarkable individual.
Well, we're running long, but I want to touch on one more event about Tommy McGuire before we pause the ace race here in the end of 1943. And I'm not going to get every instance here, but on December, this is again further example of this man's leadership and his desire to do whatever he could to further the cause. On December 26th, 1943, McGuire leads his flight from the 431st Fighter Squadron to cover the Marine landing at Cape Gloucester, New Britain. This is another episode for another time, but we're going to get to Cape Gloucester. He's vectored towards an incoming flight of enemy aircraft. He drives his men towards this incoming flight. What he notices about this flight is that it's fighters, but below the fighters are Val dive bombers. And he's not stupid. He realizes these Val dive bombers are heading towards the invasion fleet that is lying offshore. He knows that the fighters can do damage to those ships offshore, but those dive bombers are going to do a hell of a lot more damage than the fighters are. So to that end, he elects to attack the dive bombers as opposed to attacking the fighters, which is a good tactical and strategic decision for sure. Absolutely. He shoots down three planes in this fight. And this fight is not special because he shoots down the three planes. Like you said, he shoots them down in gobs here and there, here and there. It's because, again, he elects to go after these Vals, knowing that they will cause more death and destruction than will the fighters, and in turn puts himself and his flight at risk from the fighters that do attack them as they're attacking these Vals, because he knows these are the guys that I need to kill. I can take care of the fighters later. These are the dudes I need to bring down. Because of this action, he's awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. And I'm going to read this citation before we wrap it up. Major McGuire was, by now he's a major, obviously. Major McGuire was leading a fighter squadron on protective patrol over an Allied invasion convoy off Cape Gloucester when 35 enemy aircraft were sighted. He immediately directed a frontal assault. The attack began, and an additional 15 to 20 enemy fighters dived on the squadron, forcing it to lose tactical advantage by evasive action. At this time, Major McGuire saw below him 35 dive bombers preparing to attack the convoy. Faced with the difficult alternative of risking a diving attack on the bombers, which would leave his squadron mercilessly exposed to the enemy fighters above, or of concentrating on the fighters at the expense of the convoy, Major McGuire, electing to perform his mission to protect the convoy at all costs, ordered his squadron to intercept the enemy bombers. Successfully eluding enemy fighters, two flights were able to make a devastating attack on the hostile formation. Under his brilliant leadership, the squadron destroyed 10 enemy dive bombers and three fighters. Major McGuire's conspicuous heroism and unrelenting aggressiveness were responsible for defeating the enemy attack and saving the convoy. Major McGuire's unquestionable valor in aerial combat is in keeping with the highest traditions of the military service and reflects great credit upon himself, the 5th Air Force and the United States Army Air Forces. Again, he just does it again and again and again and again and again.
Absolutely selfless. Yeah. And that was Tommy. He was an incredibly selfless guy. And I'm not sure how many squadron leaders, flight leaders, mission leaders would have made the same decision. You know, it would have been significantly easier to go after the fighters and just tangle with the escort. But he knew the priority, of course, was the bombers. He knew that the lives of hundreds and hundreds of sailors and Marines were on the line. And he blew right through the fighter escort using speed to give him and the rest of the squadron a quick opportunity to do as much damage as they could before the Zeros got down on him. And he was able to break up that attack. I mean, it's a remarkable story. I'm really glad you highlighted that one, Seth, because again, he gets overlooked.
He really does. And he shouldn't. I understand, you know, we all understand, or hopefully the watcher listeners understand by the end of this, why he often does get overlooked, but, and we'll go into more detail next time we talk about these two cats, we'll go into a little more detail about Tommy, but he was, in my opinion, the finest aviator to wear Army wings in the Pacific, and very well maybe the entire Army Air Forces during World War II, for sure. He was skilled beyond belief in his unquestioning, as you said, devotion, leadership ability, and just being a hot pilot. You know, he was the best of the best, in my opinion, and he comes in just a hair short at the end of the day.
You know, but I wonder, Neil Kirby was an incredible pilot. Over and over and over again, tangling with his fellow pilots for years in the skies over Michigan or wherever else he was stationed. You know, Neil could beat guys while eating an apple or smoking a cigar or cigarette. The thing that is the distinction between the two of them is Neil learned to fly in the mid 30s. I think he came out of training in 36 and got into his first squadron late 36 or early 37. Tommy was a lot younger. He was a wartime pilot. I mean, he trained just prior to the Pearl Harbor attack. But he came up in combat. Mm-hmm. And he came up in active squadrons in combat theaters. He had to learn all the things that Neil learned in the comfort of, you know, the stateside postings under fire, and where lives were on the line, not just, you know, in terms of training accidents and you know, equipment failure, but also, you know, through enemy action. And so what you say, I think, is very, very true. He was an incredible pilot.
Yep. We're gonna put a pause, a timeout on the ACE race here, because this is a good stopping point. It really is, because Bong's back in the U.S. He's leading the pack with 21. Kirby is Neil Kirby that we've talked about briefly. He's number two, and he's chasing Bong, and he's getting close.
And he's the newcomer. Boss.
Yeah.
Temporarily.
Yeah. Yep. He's an interesting dude. We'll next time we get together and we talk about him, we'll talk about these guys. We'll talk about Kirby in a little more detail, because he's an interesting cat who makes a very, you know,
phenomenal. Yeah. Phenomenal human being, a phenomenal leader. But, you know, really what happens to Neil happens to
fixated
Dick and Tommy later on too. The only one who really escaped that fixation was Charles McDonald, and actually in Gerald Johnson too.
Yeah. They get fixated on it. Yeah. It does become a race. It really does. It really does. So you got Bong at first, Kirby at second, and Tommy McGuire's at third as we close the end of 1943. And there's so much more to talk. And we've talked a long time, but there's so much more to talk about. And we will get into this subject again as our war progresses. John, Bill, is there anything before we wrap it up? Is there anything else you guys want to throw in about this period, 1943, of these guys? I mean, we've covered a lot, but I mean, these are incredible. Yeah,
I think
people.
This might be our longest episode, but I would say that being a Navy focused guy, this has been very illuminating for me, and just really an important aspect of the war that many of us that look at the Pacific War as a naval war, tend to overlook. And so it's really important that we cover this. So thanks, John, for part one of our coverage of the Race of Aces.
Thank you, Bill. It was a real pleasure to be here, and I really appreciate the time to be able to talk to your audience about these guys and who they were. Means a lot to me.
Well, it's a worthy topic. It's, you know, people know who Dick Bong is, and I would venture to guess that most people that watch our show, that listen to our show, know who Tommy McGuire was. But yeah. I'd also venture to guess that a lot of people don't, or at least they don't know what kind of a cat he really was. They just think, oh, well, he got 38 kills. Yeah, well, actually probably got more than that. But regardless of this, he got, you know, he's second. He got 38 kills. He was an incredible, like you said, John, he's an incredible human being. Consummate leader, really. Consummate combat leader. With that, I'm going to close. But before,
like all human beings, but like all human beings, he had his flaws. And we talked about that with the Packy Boyington story.
Yeah,
we're going to, you know, everybody, including, you know, Dick Bong.
Yeah. So for those who haven't read it, read this. This is an absolutely phenomenal book, Race of Aces by John Bruning. This isn't a commercial for John's book, but I have to say this, and I'm just going to throw this out there real quick before we go. Like you, Bill, you know, I'm a naval aviation guy. I'm a U.S. Navy guy. I'm Marine Corps, you know, history. I knew about Dick Bong. I knew about Tommy McGuire. I did not know the intricacies of their personalities or their stories. Or really, I didn't know a heck of a lot about the ace race. I knew there was one, but not to the degree. A buddy of mine called me and he says, you need to read this book. I'm like, all right, fine, I'll get it. So I bought the book and it sat on my desk for about a month. I was like, I'll get to it. And he calls me up and he's like, have you read the book? I said, no, not yet. He's like, read the damn book. I opened the book. I swear to God, I open a book, I read it, and I can't put it down. It is absolutely, I mean, I'm finished now, but I could not put the damn thing down. It is absolutely phenomenal. Those who haven't read it, pick it up, read it. You will not be disappointed, I assure you. It really is.
And a good writer, John.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate that. This was the second of my bucket list books. I was involved in a helicopter mishap in Afghanistan in 2010. And I was sitting there thinking, God, you guys made me choke up. You know, if I get back, there's a couple of things I want to do. I want to write about these guys again and tell Gerald Johnson's story along with them in a way that is different from the context that I wrote in Jungle Ace. Because now that I've experienced combat, I have a much better sense of what the heck I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of my bucket lists that I came up, or items that I came up with. And Indestructible was also writing about Pappy Gunn. Yeah. And Hachette has given me the opportunity to do both. And for that, I'll always be grateful for that opportunity and for the company to, you know, roll the bones on a guy who, you know, prior to Indestructible, I had written and collaborated with people. I co-wrote Outlaw Platoon with Sean Parnell and House to House with Medal of Honor recipient David Bellavia. But they really took a chance on me and they gave me the opportunity to do the research that really these two books deserved and the people in them really deserved. So I was really, really fortunate.
Oh, highly, highly, highly agreed. And definitely check them out. So with that, we want to thank you for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast, wherever you receive your podcast. Watch our videos on YouTube as well. Like and subscribe there too. We would certainly appreciate it. If you have a question or a comment, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. So once again, my name is Seth Parrott, and I want to say thank you very much, Bill.
I'm Bill Toady. We'll see you again next week.